An EU army is being developed. Social inequality is a growing problem, but there is no end of money for lethal weapons.
An enormous amount of equipment, ammunition, weapons have already arrived in Ukraine. But of course there are bottlenecks, there are challenges, and there also are some requirements, for instance, for training, for spare parts, to be delivered together with the specific weapons.
Even Pope Francis says the war in Ukraine was provoked or not prevented by the West. Last September, an EU agency outlined the incredible scale of corruption in Ukraine. Despite this, Kiev looks poised to join the 27-nation bloc.
Yes, Ukraine deserves European perspective. Yes, Ukraine should be welcomed as a candidate country.
Economists say sanctions against Russia are going to push up prices in the EU even more.
And some suggest Euroscepticism is going to rise like never before, resulting in the EU project crumbling by the year 2030. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thousands of people came from across the UK Saturday to protest outside Parliament. Trade union leaders have joined frontline workers and community organisations to call for higher wages and support. The government says there is just so much it can do, though, blaming the situation on a global energy crisis and the conflict in Ukraine. In a long-winded address, the Chancellor of the Exchequer promised a payout to ease energy bills, but it's too little, too late.
The cost of living crisis here in the UK is real. Everything from food, fuel to rent has gone up in price. And that means people across the country are having to tighten their belts. And that in turn means fewer donations to food banks and more mental health challenges.
Food banks say the number of people turning up has increased massively. And the kind of people turning up has most definitely changed. People in full-time work and key workers. Even with both adults working, households are struggling to make ends meet.
My daughter, Jess, she's a nurse, and she had to borrow money off me to pay for the car to get to work. And it's an intolerable position that the NHS staff and all workers across the country with the inflation, interest rates going up, cost of living, and we've had enough of it.
The government says it cannot completely mitigate the effects of the crisis. The Trades Union Congress, however, says while real wages across the economy are down by £68 a month compared to a year ago, bonuses for city executives has risen exponentially. So money is not reaching those who need it most, and until quite recently, were hailed as heroes.
Our postal workers that worked through COVID, that kept the country going, that were in fear of their own life for the people back home, but they stepped up to the plate, they worked through it all, and they deserve a better pay deal. So we're here with these unions to say to the government, pay our people. You clapped us, now pay us.
Although these are hard times, people at today's protest slammed the Tory government's immigration policies as well.
The thing is, they've had to come in illegally because we've closed all the quarters for us to come in legally and then just deporting them out of the country to Rwanda. It's disgraceful, particularly when this government not so long ago imposed sanctions on Rwanda because of the human rights atrocities. So there you go, that's my point.
War and famine and climate change are creating terrible situations across the world, and we want to make that better. But whilst people are trying to get away from that and seek refuge and seek asylum in our country and other countries in Europe, they should be welcomed. They should be given safe passages and they should be welcome here.
The price hikes are the worst in half a century and taken off guard many Britons, 15% of which were already food insecure, are now having to choose between heating their homes and eating. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Cheongwa-dae, South Korea's Blue House, is now open to the public. The presidential office has moved, with the former grounds becoming a park and popular attraction. The move was finalized just weeks before incoming President Yoon Suk-yeol's inauguration. The new office is in South Korea's Ministry of National Defense, adjacent to a U.S. military base, with the government this week opening a park there on a 10-day trial. President Yoon moved the presidential office to leave behind what he called the era or symbol of imperial power and get closer to the people. It's been suggested that visitors to this park will be able to see the president working in his fifth-floor office. Just one problem. The park is polluted with toxins in the soil and groundwater many times the levels otherwise considered safe. An environmental catastrophe a long time in the making, say activists.
These facilities have never been restored from their use by the Japanese Army and then the U.S. Army. You can find the boiler tubes and pipelines, which have decayed underground, leaking oil, resulting in the gradual accumulated contamination of the soil, not just from 1 or 2 years, but over decades.
The U.S. base is in the process of returning to South Korean control. According to government surveys, benzene, xylene, and other hydrocarbons, as well as arsenic and cancer-causing dioxins, have been detected at harmful levels in more than 60% of the area.
After the entire U.S. base is returned, they should execute a detailed investigation into how contaminated it is and establish a plan to clean up the pollution. And after the cleanup is carried out and verified, then the park can finally be built. According to the original government plan, it'll take about 7 years.
The Yoon administration plans to open the park fully in September and feature an American-themed culture zone, or Little L.A. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Scads of emails to FIFA and no answers yet. Following the Canadian national soccer team's pullout from a planned match with Iran, pressures have been heaping on Canada's footballing body, Canada Soccer, for what Iranian sports authorities regard as unsportsmanlike and illegal. They have been trying different ways to reach FIFA for answers, but to no avail.
In several attempts, I tried to contact FIFA to ask for an interview with its chief executive officer, but there was no response. I also emailed their media department, but so far we have received no answer.
The Iran match was due to take place on June 5th in Vancouver as a preparatory friendly in the lead-up to the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar. But 9 days ahead of the game, Canada Soccer canceled the fixture, citing untenable geopolitical situation of hosting Iran. The exhibition match was called off days after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau criticized Canada Soccer for its decision to host Iran.
It's a pity that a country like Canada, which claims to be committed to the separation of politics from sports, so openly disregards this principle and mixes up political hostilities against Iran with the sport. It's definitely a violation of the FIFA regulations.
Days later, Team Canada set another match with Panama to replace the Iran contest. But to everyone's surprise, that game too was called off at the 11th hour. This time, Canada Soccer cited payment disputes raised by the Canadian players as the reason why the Panama match was cancelled. To Iran's sports ministry, Canada's flip-flopping is against the FIFA regulations and deserves punishment.
Our colleagues at the Iranian Football Federation are following up on the legal pursuit of the case. We are currently writing to the Canadian Soccer Association to seek a convincing answer regarding why they committed such a move. We will then take the case to FIFA to seek psychological and financial compensation for Canada's illegal action.
The Iran match was a golden chance for the 38th-ranked Canadian men to test their performance against a team that ranks 21st in the world. Now with the World Cup looming, and just 4 years prior to serving as co-host of the 2026 Men's World Cup, Canada Soccer has embroiled itself in a crisis that has the potential of leaving indelible scars on Canada's sport and its image in the world. 3 weeks after Canada Soccer's controversial move, the backlash is yet to subside. Iran says it's seriously following up on its legal pursuit to seek damages, and that has raised speculations about the possibility of the case being taken to the Court of Arbitration for Sports, known as CAS. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Humanitarian aid being loaded into a lorry. I'm heading with pro-Russian volunteers to a village near the front line, which is constantly under shelling in order to deliver much-needed supplies. Despite the destruction all around, incredibly, people still live here. We stop off next to the final checkpoint. Beyond is no man's land, the grey zone between the opposing armies. Artillery can be heard. It's unclear whether it's Russian or Ukrainian.
Now it is from both sides. Artillery duels. And we're in the middle. The shells are flying over our heads. And they might fall here. So let's just gradually move away.
Pieces of shrapnel like this are supposed to hit us. This one is small. They're bigger ones. Look how sharp it is. They cut through flesh like a sieve. These are Ukrainian gifts to our children. They're different shapes and sizes. You could keep it as a souvenir from Donbass.
Unexpectedly, in this wasteland, a bus pulls up. The man tells me his house was destroyed yesterday. He shows me his wounds. I asked him why he's come back. To get some documents and feed his cat, he says. A crowd is gathered at the drop-off point, hungry for the humanitarian aid.
There was that video showing a woman from Western Ukraine sitting on the road embracing her two children and asking, how could it be so that her house was destroyed by Russian shelling? She should ask the woman whose three children died in a bathroom from Ukrainian shelling how she felt. I also have children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. I want to live in peace here in Donbass, not watch all this going on.
It's noticeable here that most people are women and children. The men have joined the armies.
Now, the front line is only a few hundred meters away. There's a lot of emotion here, understandably, about this war. Some people here even tell me they have cousins who are fighting in the Ukrainian army, while their sons and husbands are fighting for the pro-Russians. This war has divided the country. It's also divided villages like this.
My son died on the 3rd of November. He'd been on the front line for 8 years. He went there in 2014 as a volunteer, and now he's dead. What for, I ask, what for?
Those who remain don't leave because it's their home, and they have nowhere else to go. They tell me this used to be a pleasant place to live. The same can be said of many other parts of Ukraine. The longer this war goes on, the more of this pleasant land will be destroyed. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Ahead of a planned visit by U.S. President Joe Biden to the region next month, Israeli media revealed that the American administration had raised the possibility of holding a meeting between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, but the Palestinians have rejected the idea. According to the Israeli daily Haaretz, the Palestinians informed the Americans that they would only accept such a meeting if all parties agreed on advancing a two-state solution based on the 1967 borders.
The Biden administration, with its offer to have a kind of a meeting between the Palestinians and the Israelis, is trying just to get out of the hook. It's trying to say that they are interested in doing something in the area. At the same time, what they are offering is just a kind of a arrangement, economic arrangement, make life a little bit much better under the occupation. Now, the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinians in general are aiming at ending the occupation and establishing a Palestinian state.
The Palestinians, however, want from the Americans to reopen the U.S. consulate in East Al-Quds and to remove the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, from the U.S. terror list. These demands had been made during a meeting between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs Barbara Leaf in Ramallah.
Biden's visit carries with it many risks, including shaping the situation in the region in favor of U.S. interests and those of Israel. We have demanded from the U.S. some issues that it can make unilaterally and don't require hollow meetings. It's clear the U.S. will be ignoring the major cause, which is the Palestinian cause.
On Tuesday, the White House confirmed Biden's first trip to West Asia region next month, during which he will visit the occupied Palestine, followed by a trip to Saudi Arabia. Israel's foreign minister has said that his country was looking to Biden's trip next month to help improve relations with Saudi Arabia.
U.S. President Joe Biden is planning a visit to Saudi Arabia as part of the Riyadh summit. Biden says he will be focusing on Israel as a key issue for talks during his Saudi visit. Palestinians, on the other hand, say the Biden's visit to the region would only be symbolic. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The EU is Britain's largest trading partner by some distance, and the UK is the EU's third largest customer for goods. Therefore, there's a great deal to lose if relations continue to deteriorate.
This is
illegal.
The 27-nation bloc is furious at plans by the British government to rip up the post-Brexit trade agreement relating to Northern Ireland agreed in 2020. Apparently, Boris Johnson's proposals would create a mountain of paperwork for businesses in Northern Ireland.
I mean, go and ask, I don't know, the milk producers in Northern Ireland how he or she can produce the milk, one sort for EU, another one for the UK, or any kind of manufacturer who wants to benefit from the access to both markets of the UK and the EU.
Brussels is taking London to court for not fulfilling the terms of the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol. The mechanism is designed to prevent border checks between the North and the Republic of Ireland, thereby avoiding the potential for sectarian violence. The United States is siding with the EU on this issue, which means London has limited options when it comes to finding new, big trading partners. Currently, just 15% of UK exports go to the US. And according to analysts, it would take years for London and Washington to agree on a new trade deal. EU leaders simply do not trust the British government any longer. Analysts have been surprised by the bloc's unity throughout the Brexit process after the EU spelled out its red lines.
And the EU has been very consistent in keeping to those red lines, probably more unified than anyone expected, whereas on the other side we have seen huge divisions.
This protocol presents for Northern Ireland.
It's been suggested, for political reasons, Johnson cannot back down now, and therefore it would ultimately require a change of government in London to avoid a trade war. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Georgia, United States, David Perdue challenged Governor Brian Kemp because of Donald Trump's fury over his 2020 election loss. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Reed Epstein and Shane Goldmacher. The piece is titled, Perdue Had Trump, in Georgia, Kemp Had Everything Else. In September of 2021, former Senator David Perdue was hemming and hawing about running for governor of Georgia. Over dinner with an old friend on Sea Island, he pulled out his iPhone and showed the list of calls he'd gotten from Donald J. Trump, lobbying him to take the plunge. He said Donald Trump called him all the time, said Martha Zoller, a former aide to Mr. Perdue, who now hosts a talk radio show in Gainesville, Georgia. Martha Zoller added, he showed me on his iPhone these multiple recent calls and said they were from the former president. Martha Zoller and a legion of other former Perdue aides and advisers told the former senator that running was a bad idea. He listened to Donald Trump instead. Now David Perdue is staring down an epic defeat at the hands of Governor Brian Kemp, the Republican whom Donald Trump has blamed for his 2020 loss more than any other person. The Perdue campaign is ending the race low on cash with no advertisements on television and a candidate described even by his supporters as lackluster and distracted. Perdue thought that Trump was a magic wand, said Newt Gingrich, the former House Speaker and a Trump ally, who was among David Perdue's highest-profile Georgia supporters. In retrospect, it's hard to understand David Perdue's campaign, and it's certainly not the campaign those of us who were for him expected. Mr. Perdue's impending downfall in Tuesday's primary for governor in Georgia looms as the biggest electoral setback for Donald Trump, since his own defeat in the 2020 presidential election. There is perhaps no contest in which the former president has done more to try to influence the outcome. Mr. Trump recruited, promoted, and cleared the field for his ally while assailing Brian Kemp, recording television advertisements and giving $2.64 million to groups helping David Perdue, by far the most he has ever invested in another politician. Yet the race has exposed the limits of Donald Trump's sway, especially against entrenched Republican incumbents. David Perdue's failures were not just of his own making. He was outflanked by a savvy incumbent in Brian Kemp, who exploited the powers of his office to cut off David Perdue from allies, including Mr. Perdue's own cousin, Sonny, a former governor and Trump agriculture secretary, whom Brian Kemp's allies appointed chancellor of the university system of Georgia. Governor Brian Kemp also appeared to punish those who crossed him. One congressional seat was drawn to exclude the home of a candidate whose father, a Perdue supporter, had publicly criticized the governor. And he offered goodies to voters, including a gas tax holiday that conveniently runs through to the end of May, just past the primary. On Thursday, 19th of May, as David Perdue campaigned outside the Semper Fi Bar and Grill in Woodstock, Georgia, he was not conjuring up a path to victory, but haggling over the scope of his widely expected defeat after a Fox News Channel survey showed him down 32 percentage points on his rival. "Hell no, I'm not down 30 points," insisted David Perdue, whose campaign did not respond to requests for comment for this article. "We may not win on Tuesday," he added, "but I will guarantee you we are not down 30 points. The key threshold on Tuesday is 50%. Brian Kemp must win an outright majority in the five-candidate field to avoid a one-on-one runoff in June." The story of David Perdue's efforts is less one of political collapse and more of a failure to launch. From the moment he announced his candidacy in December, Mr. Perdue never demonstrated the same commitment to winning that he displayed in his first Senate race back in 2014. His case for ousting Brian Kemp was always largely based on support from the former president, Donald Trump. Mr. Perdue argued at his campaign introduction that the governor had so alienated the party's Trump faithful that they would not rally around Mr. Kemp against Stacey Abrams, the presumptive Democratic nominee and a leading villain for Republicans. But Mr. Perdue, a 72-year-old, a wealthy former chief executive of Dollar General, never came close to matching the $3.8 million of his own money he put into his 2014 Senate race. He invested just $500,000 in his bid for governor of Georgia. That is less than he and his wife spent last year for a waterfront lot on a secluded peninsula on scenic St. Simon's Island, a purchase made not long after his runoff defeat at the hands of a then 33-year-old Democrat that delivered Senate control to Democrats. A permit to build a nearly 12,000-square-feet mansion worth an estimated $5 million on land including over 625 feet of lake frontage, according to the listing, was granted 2 weeks after he declared his candidacy, according to records. Donald Trump has simultaneously invested heavily in Mr. Perdue with his $2.64 million and sought to avoid blame as the candidate has faltered, telling the New York Times in April that The news media's focus should be on the endorsements, not the David Perdue one, to measure his influence. Donald Trump's last rally in Georgia came in late March. He did not return to Georgia, as Perdue allies had hoped, instead holding a conference call for supporters in early May. I am with David all the way because Brian Kemp was the worst governor in the country on election integrity. Donald Trump insisted on Friday on his Truth Social messaging platform. David Perdue, like candidates for governor in Idaho and Nebraska this month, learned that a Trump endorsement does not assure the support of Trump voters or Trump donors. The Trump endorsement is very important, but it's only an endorsement, said former Representative Jack Kingston, who lost the 2014 Senate primary to David Perdue and is a former Trump advisor. It's not an army of infrastructure and door knockers the way it would be if you have the Sierra Club or the NRA or the AFL-CIO. The juxtaposition between the Kemp and Perdue camps was particularly stark on Friday. Mr. Kemp was outside Savannah, Georgia, announcing that Hyundai was investing $5.5 billion in an electric battery and vehicle manufacturing plant, one of the largest economic development projects in Georgia's history. David Perdue was nearby holding an endorsement event with Sarah Palin, the 2008 Republican vice presidential nominee, who is making her own comeback attempt in a House race in Alaska. I would rather be standing on the stage announcing 7,500 jobs than standing next to Sarah Palin, said Brian Kemp's Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, a fierce Trump critic who opted not to run for re-election this year. Randy Evans, a Perdue supporter who served as ambassador to Luxembourg in the Trump administration, said the Kemp operation had been ruthless in using what he called the bullying powers of the governorship. Randy Evans' son, Jake, is running for Congress in the Atlanta suburbs. When Kemp-aligned Republican legislators drew new lines in redistricting, the younger Mr. Evans was suddenly drawn out of the district in which he had been planning to run. They cut a sliver about the size of your little finger, the elder Mr. Evans said. Jake had to move, buy a new house. Brian Kemp, a 58-year-old, leveraged the powers of incumbency in other crucial ways. He signed the measure to provide tax refunds of up to $500 for married couples, then announced on 11th of May, after early voting had begun, that those checks were in the mail. He appealed to rural Georgians by raising pay for teachers, and pleased conservatives by signing sweeping legislation to restrict voting access, to expand gun rights, and forbid school mask mandates. David Perdue's efforts could seem feeble in comparison. In March, he attacked Brian Kemp for recruiting an electric truck maker to open a factory in rural Georgia, creating thousands of jobs, because George Soros, the prominent Democratic donor, had recently invested in the company. The Kemp-Perdue contest was steeped in the drama of personal betrayal. Brian Kemp had spent weeks campaigning with David Perdue before the senator's defeat in the January 2021 Senate runoff election. By then, Brian Kemp had infuriated Donald Trump by defending the legitimacy of Georgia's presidential results. Last spring, Brian Kemp's aides said David Perdue assured Brian Kemp that he did not intend to run for governor. That June, Mr. Perdue introduced the governor at the Georgia Republican Party's annual convention. But Brian Kemp cannily had already begun the process of installing Sonny Perdue, a popular former governor, to run Georgia's state universities, an appointment that effectively put him on the sidelines. Sonny Perdue, through a spokesperson, declined to comment. Brian Kemp also preemptively secured the loyalty and fundraising might of Alec Poitvent, a South Georgia businessman who had served as campaign chairman for David Perdue's Senate campaigns and Sonny Perdue's campaigns for governor. One of many ways, the Brian Kemp operation boxed out David Perdue financially. Mr. Poitvent said he was among a host of longtime David Perdue supporters who had urged him not to run. Shunned by the state's political establishment, David Perdue tried framing himself as a political outsider. "I've been an outsider since I got into politics," he said on Thursday. But that is a difficult case to make for a former senator boasting of his support from a former president.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
French parliamentary election runoff vote has taken place, and the French president's party is projected to lose its majority. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why this has happened, what this means for France, whether Emmanuel Macron has by default now lost his control of his reform agenda, and what kind of power he will wield without a majority in parliament. Worse yet, will a hung parliament now take place and open up a period of political uncertainty in France? Well, to get the latest, first we're going to cross on over and talk to correspondent Romain Mazari, who joins us from the French capital, Paris. Romain, at this point, the projection is there. When are we going to find out? I think as we speak, the votes are being counted.
Right. These are just really estimates that came out at the top of the hour about 40 minutes ago. But usually France's estimates, because of the way that they put them together, they've always been almost really perfectly accurate. So we can really take these to heart. Barring some sort of historically unusual occurrence. What we see here, it's really a bit sort of misleading. Yes, it is a slight punishment for Macron. He's looking at 224 seats. He needs 289 to make an absolute majority, so he's fallen pretty far short of that, and he fell under a lot of projections. However, there's two important realities. When you add in, first of all, Macron is a mainstream conservative, and when you add in his coalition with the old mainstream conservatives, the Republican Party, then they're going to have a 53%, an absolute majority. So on any sort of, neoliberal reform, right-wing economic reforms, Macron is talking about, he's certain to institute the world's first one-size-fits-all pension system this fall. He's going to reform the unemployment system, all these right-wing reforms, austerity budgets. I can go on and on. The mainstream conservatives are going to join him in that. So Macron effectively does have a parliamentary majority. That's the first thing. The second thing is that voter abstention is the lowest ever in, the highest ever in French history, because Macron, even when he had an absolute majority, he would bypass Parliament regularly for his most important policies, just to avoid public discussion of right-wing austerity-minded rollbacks. So that's the reason why abstention is so high, because the average French person realizes that ever since the European Union got off the ground, really, with the Lisbon Treaty in 2009, national parliaments don't really mean anything. Macron has proven that for 5 years. So we can sit here and talk about how these numbers break down, but the reality is that even when Macron had an absolute majority and he could do whatever he wanted in Parliament, he still bypassed it. So what does this vote really mean? The real Democratic winner here, if you're talking about democracy as majority rule, the real winner is abstention, and there's a reason for that, and I just mentioned it.
Okay, thank you for that. Thanks for actually adding that important piece of information there. That's Rami Mazari, correspondent there from Paris. All right, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the debate.
All right, you got it. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Joining us is Gilbert Doctorow, who's an independent international affairs analyst who joins us from Brussels. We also have Mustafa Traore, an academic and political commentator who joins us from Paris.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. We're going to start with you, Gilbert Doctorow. Welcome. So I was going to ask you about this majority that Macron has lost based on the projections, which is to be confirmed, but usually the French are pretty correct in even their projections. We just spoke to a correspondent who said that's misleading because even though Macron has won 224 seats, still with his other party, they are going to still have a 53%, the coalition that is, they're going to have a 53% absolute majority. So maybe you could break that open for us. Does he have a majority or not overall?
Well, I wouldn't want to enter into that particular question because this is not the area of my concentrated interest in French politics. My interest is a bit removed from that of the journalist whom you opened the program with, who focused on the domestic implications regarding the neoliberal reform policies.
Okay, let's start with that then. If you agree with the fact that he's got the majority, then it just doesn't leave much to ask you except for the fact that will he then be able to freely go ahead with the reform agenda that he has, which covers a number of areas, but overall?
Let's assume that he can. But the question that France is facing today is much bigger than the question of Macron's domestic reform policy. The question number one, which has taken a lot of Macron's time in the last few weeks, is the Ukraine war. And in that regard, absolutely nothing has changed from the French election that took place today. The majority parties, taking into account both Macron and the traditional centrist parties, together represent a policy that is not opposed by the leaders of the opposition, Mélenchon and his group. They shared the foreign policy perspective of Macron. In fact, according to her remarks, Marine Le Pen was the only opposition in this election, just as she was the only opposition in the presidential election a bit more than a month ago. She is the only one who is speaking about NATO's relevance and about the correctness or incorrectness of the ruling assumption that Russia is to blame for the Ukraine war. In this regard, the issues that have been fought during the presidential and the legislative election, the issue over cost of living, is not being addressed. It's being ignored totally because the cost of living is a direct function of the sanctions that Macron and other European leaders have imposed on Russia and which have come back to bite Europe in the tail. So this election is really unimportant with respect to the issues that the French electorate found driving their voting, which is how can you bring down the cost of living. Neither Macron nor Mélenchon are in a position to address those problems.
Okay, we're going to get back to that. We have our other guests joining us now, Mustafa Traoré. Mustafa Traoré, welcome. I'd like to get one issue straight since you're in Paris, and that is the fact that we're looking at the projection that says that Macron has lost, his party has lost his majority in Parliament. However, when you add the coalition, our correspondent from Paris has said they are going to retain the 53% absolute majority. And that's very important for us to set the precedent here as to whether that is indeed accurate, which will then obviously be the platform for Macron to move ahead with his economic reforms. Are we looking at him, when you add the coalition, to have the 53% absolute majority?
Yes, this is accurate. He's right that even if he did not get the majority, he still got the power, and he can start a kind of coalition with the other parties, political parties from the right. So if the left, or if that new coalition of the left, the NUPES, if they had won the elections, if they had got the majority in parliament, things would have been different. But right now, the situation is that, of course, it's obvious that Macron does not have the majority in parliament anymore, but he can still work into a kind of coalition with the other political parties from the right. And if he does so, they will have the majority. So what it tells us that now the decisions that are going to be taken for the country are going to be more kind of right-wing ideas and so on.
Okay. Let me now try to put you to a challenge here, Gilbert Doctorow, with the approach that you had when it comes to, not you had, but what you said about Macron and even Mélenchon in terms of the Ukraine war. It's pretty straightforward can't say straightforward because we're talking about politics, but it's obvious what the impact is on France, along with other European countries and the U.S. and maybe a number of countries around the world. You're looking at inflation, you're looking at food insecurity, you're looking at high energy prices, just some that come off the top of the list. If you're having your people suffer, why are you going ahead with a war that at this point is over 100 days old? And back in May, you had Macron saying, we're going to increase the aid to Ukraine from $1.7 billion to $2 billion. That's not for
yes,
you,
it
for
is more
Mr.
Indeed.
Gilbert Doctorow. Okay. Sorry, I'll come back to you on that, Mustafa okay. Traoré.
No problem.
Well, you were asking about the policies of Macron with respect to Ukraine, which are exactly the same policies that Mélenchon has just set out in the last few weeks. And I think about something else. The pain that Europe is feeling and that France is feeling from the blowback, from the boomerang effect of sanctions on Russia hasn't really begun in earnest. We are still at the start of the summer. Energy costs are only reflected in the price of petrol at the stations, at the fuel stations, when people fill up their tanks. That is painful. Just remember that the entire yellow vest movement was all about the cost of fuel for cars and for other transport, trucks and so forth. The price of fuel at the stations has risen by close to 80% compared to where it was a year ago. But this doesn't affect the whole population. The whole population will be hit only in September and October when the heating season begins. Fuel oil, mazut, has gone up in price, has almost doubled in price since a year ago. That is an abstract statement. The reality is whether people can afford the price to heat their apartments and their homes. And we will only know that in September and October. So whoever won the legislative election today is not prepared in any way for the likely volatility and political discontent of a large part of the French population when they have to pay their heating bills. In this sense, the question of raising the pension age from 62 to 65 is absolute nonsense. The key points in Mr. Macron's reform policy are irrelevant ahead of the political storm that is likely to hit his government in September and October.
Okay, well, let's see. If you were to take a look, Mustafa Chouar, at what the French did, the French actually were able to cushion their economy quite well in terms of what Macron did, because the numbers spoke in terms of, for example, keeping the inflation low. Not only can they not handle this at this point, even though it's still lower than some other European countries, you're looking at the fact that there is this money that was spent to contain what happened during the COVID-19. There was talk about €100 billion boost that Macron, I'm not too sure, was able to implement all of it, but that did help cushion it. What is he going to do now? As our guest there said, they haven't seen anything yet until the weather gets cold and then it comes time to pay those heating bills, which people are not going to be able to afford.
I think that to understand the reason why France is helping Ukraine in this war, it is because it is more in the interest of France to have Russia defeated in this war. I'm going to try to explain this one. If you think in the short term, you might think, okay, it is not good for France. But in the long term, a victory of Ukraine over Russia is more in the interest of France. What Russia is trying to do right now is to depossess France from all its colonies. And we know that France is nothing without its colonies, its African colonies or former colonies. I call them colonies because if you look at the system that is in place today, they are still colonies. So what Russia is doing right now, Russia, and we see it clearly in Mali, and we know what is planned. So France is going to lose all its colonies. And there's lots of resources in the African continents. So what France thought was, okay, if we do not have access to the Russian gas, to Russian oil, we can still have access to what we are going to get from the African continents.
Okay.
But so I think that it is like limiting ourselves if we just look at it as a European issue. We've got to understand that France is nothing without its African colonies. And this is what Russia is trying to destroy today.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. I get the feeling, however, Gilbert Doctorow, speaking or listening to the comments that you made, that Macron's drive for reform, whether it's in the pensions to get it to up the or increase the age or for taming inflation and all this, that's going to mean nothing because the country, like many other countries, European countries, are going to face a real economic downturn, even though they're going through the midst of it right now. So none of this is going to matter unless you get some major problems resolved, like the French involvement in the Ukraine war. But that's not just France. So how can Macron think about taming its economy to levels that are that show improvements like inflation without ending the war in Ukraine? I mean, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. So what does he have to do here?
Well, the assumption is that France, that Europe, the United States can end the war in Ukraine. The Russians will end the war in Ukraine without any help, thank you very much. And I see that happening in the next 3 to 4 weeks with an attrition rate of 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers killed daily, with 50 Ukrainian general and senior killed in one earlier today by the Russian military. It is inconceivable that they will have a workable armed army more than 3 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks from now, because their soldiers will either desert, they will give themselves up as prisoners, or they will be killed in the field. And now, to come back to the remark of my fellow panelist about how taming Russia is in France's interest for the long term, but if it were possible to defeat Russia, and I believe it is impossible, because their armed forces are at least the same strength as NATO and possibly better, they have vast reserves of military weaponry that they have not yet used, because this is not a war from Russia's perspective. It's a special military operation. If it were a war, then you can be sure Mr. Schulz and Mr. Macron would not have been able to visit Kiev as they did in the past week, because Kiev wouldn't exist. But let's get to the point. The point is that if Russia could be defeated, then we will have a nuclear war. That is clear as day. The only possible result of a defeat for Russia is a nuclear war in which France will not have a future. It will be erased from the face of the earth. That is simple fact for anyone who knows the military powers of Russia today and the intentions of their leadership, who have said that they cannot imagine a world without Russia. So if the United States pursues a cancel Russia policy, and if France continues to be subservient to the United States in this policy, then we will have a nuclear war, and all of us will be gone, which is very sad.
All right. Well, so much for discussing French politics in terms of just the domestic side of things. What's the matter? My last question, since we're running out of time. Macron needs to do something about the economy. It needs to address the problems that exist, just like other countries in the EU. We're looking at an economy that has large amounts of debt, and it's obviously increasing so much more with the Ukraine war. What is his biggest challenge and the first step he's going to take in that regard?
I think that Macron has no solution. France is just collapsing. We are just witnessing the collapse of the French nation. And this is one fact. There are lots of contradictions when you look at what Macron is doing and what is in the interest of the country. Condemning Russia, but at the same time trying to get some gas from Russia. So there are lots of contradictions. I think that now we have no solution. The only reason why sometimes we've got the feeling that France is slightly better is because France is exploiting its African colonies.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Mustafa Traore, academic and political commentator.